It's simple, really. Wine is alcohol made from grapes. Squash grapes into a bucket and the juice soon becomes intoxicating. Wherever grapes grow, we've been drinking wine, it seems, since the beginning of time. There's a bit more to it, of course. The gods come into it, so do the enemies of pleasure. Wars are fought, poems are written, mighty claims are made. Among the mightiest, Pliny the Elder's, in vino veritas, in wine is truth. Well, maybe, on a good night. Arriving in our bookshops in October will be a new history of wine, from the late Stone Age to 2025, written by the University College of London historian, Kathleen Burke, who joins me now from the UK. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I look forward to chatting with you.
It is so easy, isn't it? You just squash up grapes, leave them for a while, and it turns into alcohol.
Yes, of course, the quality is debatable. Yes. But you're right. All you need are grapes.
And you make the point that it hardly needed to be invented. It was just there for people to make something of. And they did.
Well, yes, they did. They did. But of course, it was back about 10,000 years ago or so. Some early Neolithic people were stomping through the forest looking to hunt for something. They heard birds. They looked up. They pulled grapes down because if the birds were eating them, they wouldn't be poisonous. Liked them, filled their sacks or whatever, and took them back home and left them there. And in due course, although it started out cold, they could see it was all bubbling and it was warm. And when the bubbling stopped, they either had someone offer or they forced someone to put their finger in it and taste it. Then they put a ladle in and forced him to drink it. Would he die? No, what he got was intoxicated. You know what you do when you're highly intoxicated. You grab people. You either say you love them or you're going to kill them. And he kept drinking and finally just fell on the floor and woke up the next morning nauseous and ill.
You make the argument that because it seemed like magic, there was this connection to the gods, there was this possibility that this was something to do with gods, a gift of some kind, and it features in so many religions.
Many of us know about the story in the Bible where Noah plants the first vines, makes the wine, gets intoxicated in his tent, and then he's discovered. And of course, the land of Canaan, which includes Israel and Lebanon and part of Syria, was really where it went from that area out to the Mediterranean. But of course, if you think about it, how did it get from Georgia to there? And it went through Turkey, and it was picked up by all sorts of empires, and it got carried to the West. And when we get to the Canaanites, about 12th century BC, it really starts spreading around Eastern Mediterranean and then further out. So that's when wine becomes a part of, in a sense, known history.
Kathleen, all this is happening because people love this stuff. They love drinking it. They love intoxication, and there are all sorts of other domestic uses for it. Is it clear whether or not from the beginning there were also people who hated this stuff, who didn't want people to drink it, who saw it as evil?
Well, not as far as from the beginning. Of course, you have two things here. You have the Islamic world, where it's sort of a mixed story. Theoretically, it is forbidden by Allah, but all during this period of the Islamic era, including the Ottomans, a number of people drank it. A number of people wrote poetry about it. But the part everyone knows about is prohibition in the United States, when theoretically it was forbidden, but there were all sorts of loopholes that were taken advantage of. So although people on the whole really liked it, there were people who thought it was bad and did their best to try to stop it. And no place really has this been successful as far as we know.
You tell us about medical champagne.
Well, yes, and this is prohibition in the States. And one loophole is for medical reasons. And a winemaker in California called Paul Masson, which has been, you know, one of the larger ones. What they did was they made their wine, but they called it medicinal champagne, which is used, they said, for those diseases that require a draft of champagne. And so that was one of the medical reasons, in fact. One of my favorite stories, I must say.
I'm going to drink no other brand for the rest of my life. Kathleen, how serious is the Islamic objection to alcohol? Because, yes, you know, we know all about it, et cetera, but Omar Khayyam was a poet, a Muslim poet, who wrote some of the greatest poetry celebrating drinking.
Yes, two things. Yes, it is celebrating drinking, but it's also seen as a symbolic way of objecting to the extremely difficult Islamic movement at that time. And my theory is that he wrote this, and then they met in private homes. He certainly wasn't the only one doing that. And they drank a glass of wine and read it to each other. But he wasn't, of course, the only poet. There were two others that, in fact, one of them called Abu Dawas was considered by T.S. Eliot one of the great poets. So there were poets. Sometimes they were celebrated. Sometimes they got thrown into jail because they drank too much or were too licentious. But yes, poetry has been part of the life of many areas, in particular China, when the interrelationship of wine and poetry has been incredibly important ever since it was invented, discovered, and even until now. Li Bao, one of the great poets, indeed between in two centuries, the 7th century around there, 50,000 poems were written, and some of them can be people recite today. So almost more than any other country, the interrelationship of wine and poetry dominates in China.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Ma. I'm talking to Professor Kathleen Burke about her book, Wine, A Global History. Kathleen, wine in Roman times, they drank a huge amount of it, didn't they? But at what concentration?
When they were made, they were quite strong. And so they were diluted in Greece with, as far as one knows, seawater. In Rome, it's unclear, but I suspect they had moved their way to water without salt. Everyone drank it. They had to drink it. They needed it for health reasons. That is to say, water could kill you. They also drank it for, of course, religious reasons, but also for pleasure. And some of the wine was dire, much of which was drunk by poor people for calories. You only had wine and bread dominating most diets. They were drank by, shall we say, the better sort. In other words, those who had money, but they drank better wine, and they drank it for all sorts of reasons, but mainly for pleasure. They drank it in banquets. They drank it at home. So in Rome, a lot of wine was drunk. And one great thing about Roman wine is it had its Robert Parker of the day. It had Pliny the Elder was probably the first critic who knew a lot about wine. He wrote a whole book, 14, about it, in fact, which he told about the vines, told about the areas where they grew well, where they grew badly, how long they lasted, what about foreign wines. They even classified wines into five classifications, which, of course, what the French did in 1855 and still exists. So Roman wine was very important. And in fact, it spread from Rome to Gaul and Germany, where the Romans made awful wine. they adulterated it. They put it in filthy casks because apparently the barbarians liked that. And this wine, they did not send back to Rome, they sent it up to various parts of Gaul and, of course, across to Germania, as it were.
The wine they drank, the Greeks and the Romans, was it dry or sweet?
It was madly sweet. It began to be dry in Rome, but in Greece, very sweet wine was the wine that they wanted to drink. They had certain wines from certain areas. The great, says Pramnian wine, came from the island of Lesbos, for example, and the Maronian wine, which Homer used to make the one-eyed Cyclops drunk so he and his men could push a burnt stick into his eye so he couldn't see. That was this Maronian wine. And although the Greeks would dilute it probably 20 to 1, he gave it undiluted to the Cyclops. And it didn't take very long for him to fall on the ground, drunk and sleepy, while, you know, gobbets of human flesh came out of his mouth because he'd been eating the sailors.
Oh, he deserved to be punished. There's no doubt about it, Kathleen. He deserved to be punished.
Homer thought he deserved to be punished. Odysseus, this is from the Odyssey, which we now all know because the new film, they had been captured by the Cyclops. And the one problem there, which leads to most of the rest of the Odyssey, is that his father was Poseidon. He was Neptune. He was the god of the sea. And so he did his best for the next 9 or 10 years to stop Odysseus from actually getting back to Ithaca, back home.
One of the things I found so fascinating in your work is your study of how wine traveled. How did it travel to begin with? And how did the ways in which change came to the packaging of wine that made such a difference to what we drink today?
Well, wine, of course, was stored in casks. What the Romans did, in fact, was they stuffed it with cork, and then that was forgotten over centuries, and it was rediscovered in the modern period. But they sent it in casks, and the problem was you could send 4 casks if you had a wagon and about 6 to 8 oxen. And this was expensive, and somehow it might go bad. Sometimes those who were taking care of it drank some of it, and it just went off. So what gradually developed was that it went by ship, and the great country there was the Dutch. They had the largest merchant marine in the world. This is really from the 17th and part of the 18th century. And they carried this wine. They carried it as far as England. They carried it around up the Baltic, up to Hamburg. They carried it to the Far East. Remember, they had the Dutch East Indies. And so they carried wine all the way essentially around most of the known world. And so we can owe to the Dutch the actual, not only the transformation of wine, but they also developed new wines. They were the ones who drained Medoc, you know, the great area now for French Bordeaux wines. They drained it. They actually decided they needed more sweet wine. So they developed Sauterne, as in Château-Yquem. They went up to what, you know, the Loire, which is, you know, as you know, north of Paris, and discovered new areas where they could evade taxes. That was one of the things they were trying to do, was evading taxes. So essentially, the Dutch, most people don't really know about how important they were.
When did wine start to be carried in bottles?
Bottles as such really became important in the 17th and 18th centuries. The bottle, as it began to be known as today, was actually invented by an Englishman. And one thing about that is that it was so strong that you could carry champagne in it. You could carry sparkling wines, which the second fermentation, which is fermentation in bottle, could cause them to explode. The other
dangerous
thing is that, yeah, absolutely. In fact, visiting, when champagne became very important in the sort of second half of the 19th century, before they discovered how to stop this, as it were, when you visited Champaign, no matter whether you worked there or were a visitor down to the cellars, you had to wear a mask of tiny chicken wire, I suppose you might say,
Yes. So
that when they exploded as you walked through the cellar, you wouldn't get torn to pieces by these explosions.
Of course. So
it's interesting, you know, for several centuries, indeed from about the 13th century, the English were considered to have the best palates in the world. And the classification of wine in France is it first growth or second growth, was based on what the English would pay for it. So again, it's sort of forgotten by many people how important England was in that sense in development of some really good wines. And of course, the point about being able to stack these slender bottles in cellars was you got a place, you started having vintage port because they could be stored. They wouldn't have to be drunk straight away and not very nice. So bottles, as such, the ones that could, the strong ones and the useful sized ones, were invented in England.
Alas, we've only got a few minutes to go, but I wondered if you could tell us how you first came to know wine, because you grew up with it.
I grew up with it in California. We had a family farm, and my five brothers and sisters and I had to go out and we picked grapes and tied vines, and I drove tractor. When I went up to Berkeley, I had a boyfriend who had a 750cc motorcycle, and we drove around Napa, and he drove, and I tasted. Sadly or unsadly, I didn't know about spitting it out then. Then at Oxford, I discovered European wines. And from that on, my boyfriend, then now my husband, also liked wine. And we just, by the mid-80s, we had begun our current cellar. By the late 1990s, I wanted to know more about wine. I knew that I liked it, but I didn't know why it was any good. And so I sat the 3 years of the wine exams in London. And after that, I started judging and I started writing. And eventually, in 2021, to my utter astonishment and deep pleasure, I was asked to write a global history of wine, which is what I've been doing until earlier this year. So I went from picking the grapes to being able to tell other people or explain to other people how this all developed to now.
Now, if you were going out now, today, and I don't mean to spend extravagantly, but what would be the wine you would most like to just be able to go out and buy a bottle of?
Well, two things. For dry wine, wine that isn't fortified, it would be probably a great German wine. I love German wine and Austrian wine.
Some names of great German wine or Austrian wine?
Oh, those made by J.J. Prüm, those made by Huber down in Baden, the warmer part of Germany. Egon Müller, who also makes wine in Yugoslavia. The Mosel is the one lately that is the most desired wine. But the Rheingau area was the one that was incredibly famous and desired for most centuries until the First World War. England loved it. All sorts of wines now come up. Frankenweins, those that you could find in those box bottles, the ones that don't go in bins because they're sort of round with a sticking up top. If I was going to have the wine that lasted, that I really love, it's old Madeira, which lasts. I mean, there have been a bottle of Madeira was discovered a little while ago that had been in a cellar for almost 200 years. Now, I'm not sure what it tasted like by that time, but certainly I have some at home that I can open up and have a glass in the evening if I want and cork it back up. And I know that when I come again to it, say a week later, a month later, even a year later, although it usually doesn't last that long, it would be fine. I could enjoy it still. But for wine that I would sit on the Pacific Ocean with my five brothers and sisters and drink, looking at the out at the ocean, it would either for light wine, it would probably be a JJ Prume wine, or if it was going to be a fortified wine, it would either be a vintage port, I'm a port woman, or an old Madeira.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
It's been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Professor Kathleen Burke, author of Wine, A Global History, which will be in Australian bookshops in October. And we will put some of those names of winemakers that she has just mentioned on the Late Night Live website, just as a matter of information. Kathleen, two things I have to tell you. One is, I drank so much port at university, cheap, horrible port, that I can't touch it now. It's just been ruined for me for life. The other thing is that some years ago now, my father was dying, and he had collected wine, and he was very Presbyterian soul, and so, you know, there was never a good time to drink the wine that he'd put down, but he was dying, and so he said, "Look, well, let's now drink some of that old wine." And it had all gone off. He'd kept it all too long. And it's such drink your wine is my lesson, is the lesson I take from that.
Yes, especially your vintage 2000 clarets, the great clarets, which I understand you're keen on red wines.
Yes, we are.
Well, so am I. It's just we haven't talked today. Yes, if you're ever in England, David, if you're ever in England, I will take you to my wine club in London, which has 8,000 wines, 400 of which are by the glass, and we will have an utterly wonderful evening.
Kathleen, thank you. I'll take you up on that. I will definitely take you up on that. Yes. You know, I was in England for a few years, and one of the terrible things, you would take people, going to dinner, you would take people a really wonderful Australian wine, and they'd put it aside and serve you some dreadful second-rate French wine. And you'd look across the room at the bottle you'd brought, never opened. Obviously, you can tell I've led a very sad life. And thanks so much for tonight.
Okay.
Bye-bye.